Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Good evening and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Hi, Diane. How are you?
I'm good. Happy anniversary.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. 26 years.
As of Thursday, yes.
Yes. Good for you, Jean.
St. Jean, as she's known.
St. Jean.
Yes.
I'm not so sure. You two get along pretty well.
We do.
Yeah. That's good.
Yeah.
It's been a busy week for cycling here in Northeast Ohio.
Oh, really?
Oh. Cleveland City Council?
Okay.
They passed all of the previously introduced bike-related legislation before going on summer break this week.
Really?
Did you not hear this?
No,
have
I did
you,
not.
Have you been under a rock? Very good.
No, I'm not under a rock, but I didn't hear about that.
Yeah, exactly. It made the 11 o'clock news. Not like that matters. Nobody stays up to 11. But it was brought to the floor by Joe Simperman, one of our councilmen, longtime councilman.
Mm-hmm.
They passed the 3-foot rule, which, you know, there's a lot of debate about that, but it's a pro-cycling, allegedly a pro-cycling rule. An ordinance that prohibits harassing cyclists.
That's nice.
Yes. They made Cleveland part of the National Bike Registry.
Hmm.
So those were allegedly, you know, all pro-cycling. Councilman Simperman said what this is all about is saying to people that Cleveland is a bike-friendly city. He actually said those exact words.
Those are good steps in the right direction.
Yes, they are.
We need about 10,000 more of those, but those are three or four good steps.
Yeah. On the downside, the velodrome ran into a snag this week.
Oh, really?
Yes, they ran into a building permit snag from the city of Cleveland, and somebody said something about the grading of the property, the actual road, you know, the actual GRAD, not as in give it a grade. Okay.
Yeah.
So I don't know what the deal is, but Brett Davis is saying, no, we're hoping it comes through this week. And somebody on Facebook, of course, in their inimitable style said, I work for the city of Cleveland, or I'm a contractor that tries to get permits in the city of Cleveland. Don't hold your breath. So we'll see. Hopefully they'll get it done.
Yeah.
Hopefully we get it done. So there's a lot of chatter around the Olympics.
Okay.
Especially the Olympic trials, who's going to be representing us in London.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Davis Finney and Dave Zabriskie will be facing off for the single time trial slot. We're only going to be able to send one time trialist to the Olympics.
I don't think that would be Davis. Perhaps Taylor?
Oh, Taylor. Oh, you're right. It's because, you know, we just talked to Davis.
Of course.
You know what? I've had so many. Somebody else talked to Davis on the air this week. George Thomas from Ram.
Okay.
Interviewed Davis this week. All right. So Taylor Finney and Dave Zabriskie will be facing off. The U.S. qualified only one rider because you have to have somebody in the top 10 of the 2011 UCI Road World Championship time trial to get more than one.
Okay.
Taylor Finney was the top rider from the country in 15th. Zabriskie skipped the Worlds because he hadn't recovered from a crash in the Tour de France.
Okay.
Yeah. But most people think Zabriskie is going to be the best time trialist in the world right now, and he will qualify. But we'll see. We'll see. We are going to learn about training elite cyclists this evening.
Okay.
Yes, we are speaking with Hunter Allen, who, along with Dr. Stephen Chung, authored Cutting Edge Cycling, Advanced Training for Advanced Cyclists. And I'm asking him what he means by an advanced cyclist. Hunter is a former professional cyclist, a renowned coach, an expert in using power meters to train endurance athletes. He's also the founder of the Peaks Coaching Group in Bedford, Virginia, where he will be when we speak with him. So I wanted to add one other thing, because our second guest is Carrie Caffrey. And before I tell you a little about Carrie, I actually had finished the whole opening for the show. But in the past few days, there have been several stories about cyclists who have been hit by drivers and killed. Two in Wisconsin recently. And while that's bad enough, the prosecution of motorists who are at fault seem to be much less vigorous for cycling-related crashes than other accidents.
Yep.
Yeah. So I'm not going to try to analyze it. I just wanted to begin sort of this mental and little bit verbal dialogue about it so that as the number of cyclists on the roads increases, there might be some stepped up work on getting officials on board to look at the situations and deem them as worthy of vigorous prosecution as any other.
It's interesting you bring this up this week because just the other day I had a conversation with a coworker. And we were talking about bicycles, and that turned to commuting and riding on the roads. And he was saying, if more cyclists are on the roads, perhaps there will be a need for bicycle insurance as there is for auto insurance.
Isn't that interesting?
And so then we were talking about, you know, the consequences of various types of crashes. His point was, well, if a motorist swerves to avoid a bicyclist and hits another car, then it would be the cyclist's fault, perhaps, and they would be liable for the damage. And after I got done laughing, what planet do you live on?
Right.
It's not the one I live on. I said, no motorist is going to swerve and avoid a cyclist and hit a car in the process. They'll take out the cyclist to avoid the
ordinarily
car.
That's true.
I said, if a cyclist hits a pedestrian, you know, maybe there might be some bodily injury. Cyclist hits a car, the only injuries are going to be to the cyclist and to the bicycle. Not much bodily
not
injury
much
or property
car.
Damage if a cyclist hits a car. So
unless something horrible happens, like the judge Chip,
well,
remember where he went through the windshield,
and that brought us to another part of the conversation where basically it caused me to stop and think about the situations like you were talking about prosecution,
right?
And I told him, I said, well, unless you are under the influence, or you're sober and you hit skip,
right?
Or you're under the influence and you hit skip,
right?
You pretty much get away with saying didn't see him,
which is one of those stupid comments. It's like, well, if you had seen him, would you have hit him?
Of course you
didn't see him.
Right.
It's such
right.
a dumb comment.
But I said that it caused me to stop and think that those are really the only situations, DUI
right.
and hit skip or a combination of those two, where there is prosecution.
And even then, the results of the prosecution are rarely what they would be if the motorist had hit a pedestrian or mm-hmm. killed somebody in another car.
Yeah.
These people get away with a lot of stuff.
They do indeed.
Yeah. I had a short email conversation with Karen Brooks, who's the editor of Bicycle Times. She said, the answer to this is sue them. I'm like, oh, gee, more legend. Well,
but
you know what?
In Seattle this week, police announced that they made an arrest.
Yes.
You
took my news right out from under me. That's okay. You can read it.
Hit and run last July
right.
killed Mike Wang.
Right.
And they arrested Erlen Garcia Reyes, 28 years old, of Normandy Park.
This is his second hit run.
Oh, is it?
Oh, yes. This wasn't like his first one.
I didn't see that part.
Yeah.
But Mike Wang was a Cascade Bicycle Club member, 100% commuter, pretty active cyclist.
Very active cyclist.
Hit the Seattle community hard he was killed.
And this Bicycle Federation of Wisconsin is now mourning two people within a very short period of time, and both crashes are under investigation. The first one was a hit skip, but they found the person. And see, what happens if somebody runs away, by the time they catch them, whatever alcohol or drugs might have been in their system is now gone.
Yeah.
They can't test for it and really get a good reading on it, which is why they run away to begin with.
Of course.
So with that in mind,
anyway,
our second guest is Carrie Caffrey. So Carrie founded the website Commute Orlando and Cycling Savvy. And Cycling Savvy has now grown into a full-blown on-the-road training system that hopes to change the current idea about what good cycling practices are into what she believes they should be.
All right.
So we're going to have quite the nice show tonight.
Yeah, this is shaping up very well. Let's get started and talk to Hunter Allen.
We will. So Hunter is in Bedford, Virginia. Hunter, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining us this evening.
Oh, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
My pleasure. So I got a copy of your new book, Cutting Edge Cycling, Advanced Training for Advanced Cyclists, which was just published by Human Kinetics. I have a question right away about what you mean by an advanced cyclist.
Yeah, that's a great question, you know, and we went back and forth about the title of the book as well, and it's always challenging to write the title and just get the right market and make sure that we're hitting the people who really want this knowledge and are looking for it. And, you know, advanced cyclists are cyclists really who have been riding for a little while, let's say a couple of years, and have already grasped the basics of training and ready to go to the next level. I mean, they train hard, you know, they're serious about it. They don't have to race, but they're serious about improving and learning too, you know. That's a big thing. You know, a lot of folks are, well, we just do it on the weekend, you know, and not really interested in learning and about cycling, and they just do it for fun on the bike trail or whatever. Yeah, that's fine. But this is really more of the folks who are like, okay, you know, we're going to ride 100 miles, and we're going to ride it faster than we did last year kind of thing.
Well, and I certainly can appreciate that, because that's a lot of my customer, that person going to that level with his bicycle or hers. Because I can't diss the women, more than 50% of my business is women, are people who want to ride seriously. And so that's what you mean. You don't mean that they have to be, you know, competing in any kind of high performance event, just that they want to get better.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
You actually talk about the fact that the bicycle has changed so much in the past 20 years. And rather than hear it from me, how do you see those changes? And what do you think that those changes mean for today's rider?
Yeah, so, well, they definitely have. And I mean, it really has centered around all of this this carbon fiber technology and technology in general, you know, and that's really kind of what this book is about, is how does the technology change our world as cyclists, and from the bike side of it to the training side to every part of it, what's the touch. So from the bicycling perspective, I mean, I think we have a lot more efficient bikes now. I mean, our bikes are very, very well made. They're incredibly light, and they transfer the power very efficiently. You know, they allow us to be economical, more economical than we've ever been able to, because of that efficiency. So for me, that's one of the biggest things that has changed, is just that side of it. And then, you know, the other side, of course, is all of the fancy gearing and the pedals. It has made a huge difference, too, because now we're, again, back to this, you know, making sure that we're being the most efficient in transferring the power from the human body into the bike to move it forward. You know, I think the general bike itself is the same. You know, the diamond shape, of course, the geometry, not a lot of that's changed too much. We've got a lot of custom bicycles now, which are really, really nice, that you can, that we didn't have access to in the past, or, you know, it was a really long, hard way to get to and access that. Now that's become much easier. So, I think those are the bigger things.
Okay.
You know, yeah.
That's cool. And you use the word power, and that's where we're going next, because this is who you are, Mr. Power Man. So power meters is a big part of your coaching. Why is knowing power output important to training? And I get this question a lot, and I don't have the answer that I think you're going to give me. That's going to give me a new tool.
All right. Great. Excellent. Well, you know, the reason, there are lots of reasons, and so let's kind of hit the highlights on the ones that are that are to me the most important. First off, it's an immediate direct measurement of the most important physiological and physical factor in propelling the bicycle forward. All right, so it is, you stomp on the pedal and the wattage meter goes up. You know, it's ringing that bell. Here it is. There's 300 watts. There's 400 watts. It doesn't have, there isn't any lag time, which, like, your heart rate lags by 30 seconds behind the effort itself. So we have that immediate measurement right away, and then that allows you to meter, and you know, play on words here,
right,
your effort even better. Because pacing is such a huge part of cycling. Like, if you even took the sport of cycling and you cut away all of the fancy, you know, bicycle stuff and all the fancy, you know, nutrition and everything, and got down to the root, the heart of cycling, what is the actual heart of cycling? There's nothing left, the center of the onion. It is a sport of pacing. And we happen to like to do it on bicycles. You know, some people like to do it running. Some people like to do it swimming. Some people like to, you know, do it drinking beer.
And then some people don't. So they don't know how to pace themselves. Yes, I understand what you're saying.
Exactly. So, you know, all of a sudden it opens a new world in helping you to pace yourself. So that's a really key part, you know, so immediate direct measurement that leads into a better pacing strategy. The next thing that is really intriguing and a great reason is not necessarily the fact that it just measures your wattage, but it's the fact that it measures and records all of these parameters. So it's the technology itself. It's like, well, gosh, not only now do I get power, but I also get heart rate and cadence and speed and elevation and temperature and, you know, torque and all these other things that are also important variables that then are recorded every second, and you download that information and see what you did do, what you really did. Because a lot of times what we think we did and what we actually did are two different things. And so that brings us to what we can do from the third thing or fourth thing is we now use it as a training tool for actually doing it, implementing our training in the dose and response method. So here's the training dose, and then here's the response to that training dose. And since we've never had this ability to precisely measure the dose, and then we never had the ability to really measure the response because, well, you know, gosh, you might do a race, but it was really windy versus last year, so your time is slower. You know, or you get a flat tire or something happens and you think you're fitter, but you don't really know. And now we have that ability to truly know what's the dose and what's the response and are you really improving. The last thing is time effective and efficient. You know, it cuts down your training time. And that's a big part of, you know, optimizing training. To me, you know, I work with athletes of all levels, but generally, you know, I think I'm pretty normal in terms of my coaching, and the folks that I work with are generally masters riders. Now, they have between 8 and 12 hours a week to train. Not a lot, but also plenty, you know, and so, but we can maximize that time so that it's highly effective, and they can perform even better than they would have if they didn't have a power meter.
So let me take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Hunter Allen. He is the author of the new book, Cutting Edge Cycling, Advanced Training for Advanced Cyclists by Human Kinetics, who always put out really interesting and somewhat scientifically based books, as this one is. You make a comment that, quote, numbers are just random digits without any meaning unless cyclists have the knowledge and understanding of what the values mean and how to use that knowledge to their advantage. And I could not agree with you more. That is one of the things when people come to me and say, well, I had this really good laser fit, or I had this wobble knot fit, or I had this retool fit, and I still feel horrible on my bike. You need to know what to do with those numbers. Can you tell us what you think are significant numbers and which might be more superfluous? So you get a bunch of numbers and you don't know what to do with them.
Right, exactly. And it is so true, having that knowledge and understanding of what that means is critical. So for me, one of the most important numbers that we look at is what we call your functional threshold power. And that is your best average wattage that you can maintain for 1 hour. All right, so if you went out and did an hour time trial, then that would give you your functional threshold power, or we call it FTP for short. And that's what we base your fitness on. You know, it literally is the measure of your fitness. How fit are you as an athlete, as a cyclist, as a triathlete? Because when you look at the pelotons in even the Grand Fondos or in races, you know, the faster riders have higher FTPs and the slower don't, you know, they have lower FTPs. So fitness, our fitness level is critical. Functional threshold power, the best average power you can produce for an hour. Now, a lot of people won't go and do an hour time trial, or they don't even have a course that they can go for an hour without hitting a bunch of stoplights and stuff like that. So we came up with a proxy, which is about a 20-minute time trial, and you take about 5% off of that. And that's a good, close estimate of what your hour power could be. The next thing, what that then does, it allows us to set your training zones. So then that's the other beautiful part of training with a power meter is that, well, gosh, when you want to train your VO2 max, the amount of oxygen you can bring into your lungs and then take that and convert that into the blood, when you want to really stress that system, well, if you know your FTP, then all you need to do is make sure you're between 106 and 120% of that, and you are training that system. So it's like almost this little guarantee, you know, it's the confidence that it gives you and says, wow, you know, if I'm here, then I'm training this system, this zone, this physiological part of my body that I want to improve, and I'm not wasting my time. So that understanding those training zones is critical. The last set of numbers, and there's a bunch more, but, you know, the last set that's really to get started on this journey is we do what's called a power profile test. So not only do we do the 20-minute test, but we also do a sprint, so we get your best 5 seconds, which is your neuromuscular power, so how good can you contract and relax your muscles. And then we get a 1-minute test, which is your anaerobic capacity, how good can you go without producing oxygen, how fast can you recover from a short effort and then go again. And then your 5-minute number, which is back to that VO2 max number, how far, how big is your VO2 max kind of thing. Everybody's different. Some people are good sprinters. Some people are great at 5 minutes. Some people are awesome at 20 minutes. You know, so then all of a sudden when we kind of go across these physiological zones and systems in the body, it gives us a really nice picture of your strengths and weaknesses. So all of a sudden, these numbers start to make sense and say, oh, wow, well, what's my strength and what's my weakness and where should I work and what are my goals? And, you know, that's a really nice way to start to organize it.
Wow. See, I love these interviews. I learn so much. It's so cool. You talk about something that we try to explain to athletes and they don't always get it because they end up with a cold or the flu, and that's overtraining. You have a great chapter in the book about overtraining. What do you think are the signs of overtraining and what should people do to avoid it?
Yeah, that's a really great one. You know, that's really my favorite chapter in the book is the whole overtraining chapter. And the reason it's my favorite is because of the definitions of what overtraining is. And so let's just go through that and I'll kind of talk about each one.
Okay.
So the first thing that we want to really define and say clearly is overtraining, the word overtraining, that's good. That's okay. What does it mean? Right? It says you're training more than normal. That's good. That's what you want to. If you're going to get better, you have to stimulate your body with more training than normal. All right? The overload principle. Overtraining is good. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. Now, inside of that, we have a couple of other things that are really important to understand. One we call non-functional overreaching, NFOR, non-functional overreaching. That is when you get into a state of training more than normal, of overtraining, and you've been doing it for too long, and your body is not responding. It's not getting any better from it. All right? It's actually starting to get more and more fatigued, and you're getting more and more tired. Okay, so that's a state we want to avoid, non-functional overreaching. And that's what most people do, you know, if they've been training really hard for 2, 3, 4 weeks and don't take a break. They get into a non-functional overreaching state. All right, they can keep training, but they just kind of keep spiraling down.
Right.
All right?
Yep.
So the next thing that we like and what we do like is what we call FOR, or functional overreaching. That's when you are overtraining, but now you're in a place of improvement. You know, the overtraining, the more training you've been doing is actually improving you. You're getting stronger from it. You know, you're out there and you do that ride and you're like, wow, man, that was a tough ride, but you feel stronger afterwards. You feel stronger the next day. You're recovering quickly. You know, that's the place that we want to be in all the time, right? It's called functional overreaching, FOR. When we get through all of that, we get to overtraining syndrome, and that's OTS, overtraining syndrome, and that's bad. That's really bad because now you've been doing this a really long time, and you know you've gone through functional overreaching, you've gone to non-functional overreaching, and you kept on doing it, and you kept on digging that hole, and now you're in overtraining syndrome. This is where, you know, it might take months for you to recover from after you have stopped training. You know, it may be because, you know, you've gotten mono or you weakened your immune system to the place that it's just completely blown out. You may injure yourself, you know. You may be just, in this may be even burnout. You know, you just may be burned out from riding your bike on the same route every day, you know, for the past how many ever years, and you need a mental break. So overtraining syndrome can even be, you know, applied to your mental aspect and emotional side. But that's really the difference. So, you know, I like to change a lot of people's vernacular and the way they talk about this to let's think about it from these four different silos and make sure that we understand, okay, overtraining syndrome, that takes months to recover from. Non-functional overreaching, NFOR, yeah, you know, that takes a week or maybe a week and a half to recover from. Functional overreaching, you know, if you do that and meter it out really well, you can stay in that place for a long time without having to take a break. Yeah, maybe you take a break on Mondays or something like that, you know, but you're still improving. So that's really the four different definitions that I think are have really been well laid out.
Wow. Yes, they were. Very well laid out. It sounds absolutely so easy to understand when you put it that way. So I want to move backwards a little bit. You mentioned pace.
Mm-hmm.
What is perfect pace? You call something perfect pace. Number one, why does an athlete want it? And why does he or she need it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, the perfect pace is a balance. And that's something that is again, that's the one of the great things about cycling that I love is something that we're constantly learning about ourselves and how to work within that balance. You know, you want to ride right there at the edge but not go over it. And so I think that's something that is always a challenge. You know, when I think of perfect pace, I think of it in a couple different places. One is you're giving your absolute best performance and you come back and there is nothing left on the table when you cross that finish line. To me, that's the perfect pace. You haven't overdone it, but you've given everything that you possibly could and you finish and you're just like, there's no way I could have gone any harder.
I
so
got it.
That's a good one.
That is a good one.
Now, when you think about it from, let's say, a Grand Fondo or a Century ride, or gosh, you know, I want to just go out and ride 50 miles, or I want to climb this climb, then it's back to that equilibrium of giving yourself, metering out your effort so that you are able to finish strong. Okay, and that to me is, you don't want to finish so strong that you feel like, oh man, I left a lot out there. But you finish strong, and you're like, wow, you know, I'm strong in the last fifth of the event, whatever that is, whatever that distance is. The last fifth, you feel strong, you push yourself, and, you know, then you finish the race or the event, the Grand Fondo or whatever it is. But you know, it takes that discipline in the first fifth to hold yourself back a little bit. You know, so you have to say, okay, you know, a little slower than you want to go, a little slower than you think you can go. You need to hold yourself back because so many people start too hard.
Yep.
And you know, then they're done after a while. So it really makes a big difference there if they just hold themselves back, and then in the last fifth, they're even stronger.
So we need to wrap it up because I could listen to this all day. This is awesome. I'm learning so much stuff. Would you let our listeners know where they can get a copy of Cutting Edge Cycling?
Sure, absolutely. I still have, Stephen and I signed a bunch of copies. We still got about 200 copies left with both of our autographs on it.
Nice.
If you go to peakscoachinggroup.com, and that's PEAKS, peakscoachinggroup.com, and go under the store there, and we've got copies, and I'll send them out right to you.
Well, we will put a link to that on the radio station website and on our Facebook page. And I just can't thank you enough for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to us about the new book and to teach me a lot about power meters, which I really wanted to know, and about pacing and overtraining. Really interesting topics, and you seem to know them so well.
Great. Well, thank you, Diane. It's been a real pleasure.
All right. Have a great night.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hunter Allen joined us from Bedford, Virginia, where he runs Peaks Coaching.
Wasn't that interesting? At least
yes.
I found it very interesting.
Yeah. Not that I'm probably going to
buy a power meter anytime
soon. Pursue any of that.
No,
in my
understand.
Own cycling, but it is interesting academically to understand more about it.
Well, because I get a lot of people who ask me about power output,
mm-hmm.
and I understand what it means, but he's given me some more tools to really sort of expand why you would want to know that stuff and the different things that power will measure. So
mm-hmm.
I found it very enlightening, and I
yeah.
enjoyed talking with him.
Our job right now is to take a break.
Okay, good.
And then we'll come back, and we're going to talk about a subject that I really am excited about.
I knew you would be.
Yeah.
Carrie Caffrey from Orlando, Florida.
About riding on the road.
Riding on the road.
Okay. Be back right after this on The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
On Saturday, June 23rd, the North Coast Men's Chorus proudly kicks off their 25th anniversary season with a special one-night-only performance featuring guest artist and Tony Award winner Brian Stokes Mitchell. Dubbed the last leading man, this baritone has been one of the central leading men of Broadway theater since the early 1990s and won a Tony Award for Best Actor in a Musical in 2000 for his performance in Kiss Me, Kate. More information at ncmchorus.org.
I'm Greg Priddy.
And I'm Diane Leith.
And we are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. Time to move along to Florida.
Orlando. Disney World.
Okay.
And we're going to welcome Carrie Caffrey, who is the commuter extraordinaire. And she has a website called Commute Orlando and a program called Cycling Savvy. Carrie, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining us this evening.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You know, I was encouraged to get in touch with you by a mutual friend, John Schubert.
Yes, John. Good friend of mine.
Yeah, me too. And you know, I read your websites and the descriptions of what you're doing and who you are, and I have no idea what took me so long to get in touch with you. I'm really glad I did, though.
Well, I'm glad you called.
Yeah. Let's begin with your background as a cyclist. When you began riding, and especially when you became aware of all the conflicts between cyclists and motorists.
Okay. Well, I grew up in central Pennsylvania, actually, and I rode as a child on the rural roads around there. Of course, the hills are really steep there, so I did an awful lot of walking with my bike as well. But when I moved to Florida in the late 1980s, I was so excited because it was flat here. And you know, I wasn't a particularly athletic child, so the hills were a big problem for me. So I moved to this flat place, and I thought, this is fantastic. I'm going to just start riding a bicycle everywhere. And so when I moved to Orlando, I got one of those spiral-bound atlases with street atlases. I mean, we didn't have Google Maps back then.
Yeah, that's right.
And I explored all the streets, and Orlando is kind of interesting because we have a lot of lakes that interrupt our streets, so we don't have a grid. So I would carry that atlas around in a backpack and work my way through town and trying to connect the quiet streets as much as I could. But as I got more and more comfortable with the bike, I started to venture out on the busier streets. And I learned pretty fast that the sidewalk wasn't a great place to ride. It was a bit awkward, lots of obstacles and things. So I moved onto the road pretty early on in my cycling. And, but like everyone else, I rode sort of off on the right side of the road. And it was, obviously it was less frustrating than the sidewalk, but it had its challenges. One of the things that's happened in Orlando over the last two decades is that the city has just exploded with growth. And it's become more congested. Roads have become more congested. They expand them. They become congested again. And, As time went on, as the roads became more congested, that riding style became more conflict-ridden. one of the things that happened was about 10 years ago, a little less than 10 years ago, I rented some office space downtown, and I started commuting during, you know, regular commute hours from north of town into downtown. And that changed the dynamic of the kind of roads that I had been riding on. And I started to experience a lot more conflicts. And in particular, the road that I rented office space on had a bike lane. And that's where a lot of my problems were happening.
In the bike lane?
In the bike lane.
Interesting.
It was, and you know, my feeling when I rented the office there was, oh wow, you know, I'm renting an office on a street with a bike lane. Isn't this great? And within the first year, I got hit by a car in that bike lane.
Oh.
And I had, you know, that kind of rattled me a little bit. And I, you know, I became much more vigilant as I rode down the bike lane, but I continued to have close calls. And it was that experience where I got to the point where I had a stupid motorist story for every trip, you know, and I was starting to get, you know, really angry and frustrated and develop this kind of us versus them mentality. And it was that kind of drove me into advocacy. And so what I did was, you know, I started researching things, and I ended up getting hooked up with Mike Wilson, who's our Metro Plan bike specialist. He's a smart growth planner now. And that was kind of how I got started, was trying to figure out how to solve my problems and look for the solution to my first inclination was, what kind of signs do I need to put up? What kind of color do we have to paint this bike lane to make the motorist notice me? But through the course of my research, I actually learned that I could change my own behavior and make those problems go away.
Yeah, you came up with a very enlightening comment. You said that you became convinced that the greatest challenge facing the promotion of cycling is the destructive belief system Americans have developed about our roads. What exactly do you mean by that?
Well, this is the interesting thing. When I started out, I started to research bike lanes, as I said, and I started reading studies, and then I started reading critiques of studies, and that led me to some forums where there were advocates who were basically saying, you know, the bike lanes weren't a good idea, and that they didn't have any problems riding on the roads. And of course, that was intriguing. I thought it was silly, because how could they not be having any problems on the roads when I was having so many? But when they started talking about how they were riding more assertively and they were riding out in the lane, or they would ignore a bike lane, I thought, well, you know, that can't possibly work, because, you know, I understood physically, I understood the logic of it, but I thought, well, that can't possibly work, because the motorists think they own the roads. Roads are for cars, and we can't just get out there like that. And that's really the crux of it, is the belief that, and this is the belief that inhibits people from trying this, is this belief that, you know, the motorists own the road and the roads are for cars, and, you know, everybody else is kind of an interloper and should stay on the edges. And what I found when I started looking into crash causes was that if you looked at the behavior caused by that belief, it was feeding the vast majority of the bicycle crashes.
Interesting. Well, and I've looked at your website, which is fascinating, by the way. You are by trade an illustrator and evidently an animator.
Yes, I am. I'm a technical illustrator and a graphic designer by trade, and I've taught myself to do flash animation so that I could do the animations that are on the website.
Which are just brilliant, because if you don't need any sound, all you need to do is watch it, and you can see. Now, the guy who sits across from me is Greg Pretty, and Greg rides the way you say is the right way to ride. And he also is one who says, bike paths, cycle tracks, I don't need that. You know, be an assertive rider and be a confident rider. What do you believe is going to change the way people perceive cyclists who take the road? I mean, how does that change the way the cars actually interact? And if they're not yelling at you or throwing something or honking, how does that start to change?
You know, well, this is fascinating, because I think if you just ask the average motorist, you know, out of context, how would you feel about a bicyclist riding down the middle of the lane. The average motorist would say, well, that's ridiculous. It's unsafe. They'd be in the way. You know, they shouldn't. And you know, they'd probably couch it in safety because they don't want to say that, oh, it might delay me, because that would sound selfish. But they would react negatively to it. But what's interesting is that I find that I experience a lot less hostility riding more assertively than I did when I rode on the edge of the road. And Mike Wilson and I have actually done some video to explore this concept. But what happens is when you ride assertively, the motorist sees you so far away that they're able to change lanes and make decisions before they ever have to take their foot off the gas.
Aha.
And it's amazing. What happens is they change lanes and they go on their way. And the only people that ever make noise about it are the people who have this strong belief that you shouldn't be there. And it wasn't because you inconvenienced them. It's because they don't believe you should be there. And that's essentially a form of bigotry.
Well, yeah, obviously. It's the I own the roads and you don't. I do understand that. I do understand
exactly.
That. So you developed something called Cycling Savvy.
Yes.
Which is actually a training course, yes?
Yes. What happened was through the years that we were developing information for Commute Orlando and interacting with readers, we realized that people learn things in many different ways. There are some people who can read an article or they can read effective cycling and go out and put it into practice. They can read words, put it into practice. There are other people for whom the video works because they get the vicarious experience and they see how it works and they go out and try it. That's how it worked for me. I saw videos that were done by Dan Gutierrez and Brian D'Souza in California. And that was what encouraged me to change my behavior. But then there are many people, and I would say probably most people, who need to have an experiential process in order to learn these things. If nothing else, to have the courage to try it. So what we did was we built an experiential course around the concepts that we had been developing over the years for Commute Orlando. And we added new information and worked on an experiential model that would allow us to take people out on the road and give them the opportunity to try the behaviors in a sort of a safe group setting.
So you actually came up with a training sort of mechanism, a practical training mechanism. How is Cycling Savvy different from what the LAB teaches? And I don't want to go into an LAB bashing. I just want to know why Cycling Savvy is different and how what people learn from you may be more effective than what they learn from the LAB training.
Well, the primary things, there's several ways in which it's different. First of all, we don't do anything but traffic cycling. We don't do tire changing. We don't do accessories. We don't do mechanics,
okay,
nutrition, bike fit, because the bike shops are doing that and they're doing that well. And so we have taken the time. People's time is valuable. The time they give us for the course is far more valuable to them than the money they pay for the course. And so we use the time they've given us to teach them the essential skills for riding in traffic. So the course is 9.5 hours long, which is about the same length as the league's course, but it's all traffic cycling. Then the next thing that's really, really important is that we very, very deliberately cultivate belief change. And the other courses out there weren't designed specifically to attack the cultural beliefs that inhibit safe behaviors. And ours was. And Mike and I have done a lot of reading and a lot of research on methodologies for influencing beliefs and behavior, and we incorporated those methodologies into the course. And they're woven throughout the course, and the progression with which the information is delivered is very deliberate to help a person rid themselves of those inhibiting beliefs that keep them from being able to adopt the behaviors. The next thing is we teach what we call vital behaviors, and this is important because vital behaviors encompass a lot more than just lane position. Vital behaviors encompass communication, understanding of traffic flow, planning ahead, understanding the system and learning how to exploit the system, things like traffic signal timing in order to get the road to yourself, for example. And so we have a series of vital behaviors which we deliberately teach, and they're much more comprehensive than any other traffic cycling program, and many of the things are unique to Cycling Savvy. They aren't seen anywhere else. Lastly, we take students from the very, we can take a novice who is just learning to start and stop their bike and balance, and you know, people who don't even know how to use gears. And the way we've designed the course is we have developed progressions in both our bike handling session and in our road session. So we can take a novice all the way from the start to have her go through a really intimidating interchange by the end of the day.
Wow.
With confidence. And what's cool about that is that not only does the novice get the full experience, but because we deliberately choose intimidating road features, because there's no point in teaching people how to ride on residential streets. They know how to do that. We deliberately choose features where we can teach people the tricks and strategies and vital behaviors to make these features easy. We can take experienced cyclists through the course, and they're not bored. They come out, and it's worthwhile for them as well, which most people don't even realize this is possible. But we've done it, and it works really, really well, and it's so cool to be able to see somebody who comes into the class with, you know, having ridden only on the sidewalk, for example, and then leave the class having gone through these intimidating intersections, and then they'll contact me a week or two later, and they'll say, "Hey, I want to ride through this interchange. I just want your advice on it."
Wow.
And I'll give them the advice, and off they go. And all of a sudden, the world is open to them. They can go anywhere, because what we've done is we've given them, John Schubert actually calls it the Rosetta Stone. We've given them this tool set that they can apply to any road feature they encounter.
How many people have gone through the Cycling Savvy courses?
You know, I've lost track because we are now in 9 states.
Oh, so where is Cycling Savvy? Obviously, this is now a real course. It's taught. I mean, how many instructors are there? You're in 9 states, so that means you need instructors for 9 states.
We have 41.
Okay.
41 instructors. And we are in, let me see if I can remember them without going to the map. Obviously, we started in Florida because
right.
We started here in Orlando.
Okay.
And we're in several cities in Florida. And the first state that we added was Missouri.
Okay.
And Maine, let's see, we had Maine and Missouri, and now we have a really, really strong program in Dallas, Texas.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And you know what? Dallas is a wonderful place to ride a bike. Let me just put in a plug right there.
Okay.
Because I've ridden a lot of miles in Dallas. It's a great city to ride a bike.
Both
in.
Greg and I just sat up and went, really? That would not be something we would think, but go Dallas. Okay.
Yeah. So we're in Texas, we're in Illinois,
okay.
Michigan,
okay.
Vermont,
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, okay.
Massachusetts, Connecticut.
And now you're coming to Ohio.
We are going to be in Columbus for a regular Cycling Savvy class, which I think is almost full, but there may be a few slots left.
Yeah, that's a couple of hours south of us, and I do know about it. I contacted a friend of mine down there who's with Consider Biking and said, "Are you in this class? Go get to this class."
Absolutely. That would be fantastic.
Right.
So, yeah, and I know there are a bunch of people there that are interested in starting a program, so I have a feeling that we'll see a few of them in our next training.
Do you think that having a course like Cycling Savvy makes a difference on the legislative end, and can it make a difference on the legislative end? Will legislators start to look at this?
I would hope. You know, one of the things that one of the reasons why we wanted to promote education and why we wanted to start this course was that we were recognizing that as long as bicyclists were operating in ways that first of all, made bicycling seem dangerous because it leads to crashes. Second of all, they're unpredictable. And then there's also quite a bit of scofflaw behavior, which is, you know, pretty flagrant and noticed.
Yeah.
And our thought was that if we could improve bicycling behavior by teaching bicyclists how to be successful within the system, that they would then influence the culture around them, because bicyclists they're going to influence the motorists who encounter them.
Right.
And so our hope was that by doing that, you know, the legislature's kind of responds to the culture, that hopefully we would be able to create a paradigm in which our culture began to recognize that bicyclists do fare best when they operate as normal traffic and when they drive their bicycles as drivers, and that would help to change the legislative process. The restrictive laws, I think, are the biggest problem that we have. The fact that you know, we just got a mandatory bike lane law in Florida a couple of years ago, and that makes defensive driving really hard.
Right.
Because defensive driving usually involves getting out of the bike lane.
So what's the future for Cycling Savvy as far as continuing to grow your program? I mean, are you being funded well enough? Are you finding people who are willing to take the course and then turn around and teach it? Is it going to continue, going to be able to continue to flourish and grow?
I believe that it will, because it generates a great deal of enthusiasm.
Okay.
It generates a great deal of enthusiasm in our students, whether or not they want to go on and become instructors. They go out and they tell all of their friends how great it was, which is really powerful. It's a great side effect to the program, is that we inspire them so much that they do advertise. And so there's a great deal of enthusiasm around the program. Now, funding, not so much. This has been a volunteer effort. To date, the creation of it was a volunteer effort, and currently the administration of it is. Now, we do have some grant funding coming in from the state of Florida in order to enhance the program in the state by spreading it to other cities. But we are, you know, I think that's our biggest challenge, is trying to find some funding sources that will allow us to grow some of the systems behind the program. We're currently working on a national registration system where it will be very easy for people to come in, find a class in their area, and register for it. And that's being done by volunteers. We want to develop a member back site to our system, where after a person takes a course, they will then have access to course materials and other information that will help them continue to practice the behaviors that they learned in the class. So there's a lot of things that we want to develop to make the systems better. Another thing that we'd like to do is we would like to develop a family program so that we can teach parents to teach their children.
Uh-huh.
Because I think that one of the challenges with the school-based programs is that as long as we have these dysfunctional beliefs in the culture about how a person should ride, you know, like, people are still telling their kids to ride against traffic.
Right.
You know, it's not even a matter of just being on the edge. They're telling their kids to ride against traffic.
Right.
As long as we have that belief system, if trying to teach children in the school system, and that is even if you can with all the testing and the other stuff that's taking up time, they go home and their parents are going to undermine what you taught them if you don't teach the parents too. So that's another angle that we want to explore, is how we can go into community centers and churches and help parents learn better behaviors and help parents learn to teach their children, so that maybe their children will be able to thrive without an automobile. And that will make, you know, that'll make everything better, because cars are so darn expensive and insurance is so darn expensive.
Well, and you have the pollutant factor, and you have the health factor, and you have the obesity factor, and the diabetes. You know, it's a big pie that could get, you know, shrunken down. Well, would you tell our listeners how they can learn about Cycling Savvy?
If you go to cyclingsavvy.org, that brings you into the website, and from there you can see there's a map which shows you which regions that we're in, and then each region has its own individual feed, so you can sign up for feeds from individual regions or from the entire site.
Well, and I think everybody should at least take a little bit of time and look at your videos. Number one, they're just clever as hell. And number two, they make a very quick visual impact as to the difference between the way we're being told to ride, hugging the side of the road, and to what Cycling Savvy is saying will happen if you ride more defensively and more confidently.
Mm-hmm.
So I really appreciate you speaking with us this evening, Carrie, and I wish you a lot of luck. I think you have got a really interesting program, and I hope our listeners enjoyed our interview. I did. I'll keep watching. I love your animations.
Great.
They're
thank you
awesome.
Very much.
Well, thank you, and I hope you have a good evening.
You too. It was great chatting with you.
You too. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Carrie Caffrey joined us from Orlando, Florida.
Yes, she did.
Oh, she is.
She's your new hero.
You know, it makes sense that she and John Schubert are in cahoots because they have a similar philosophy and one that I admire greatly.
I was remiss to wait so long to talk with her because
yeah.
John told me about her a year ago and it slipped through the cracks. And then something brought it up again and I went, you know, it's one of those smack yourself upside
yeah.
the head and go, duh. And I looked at her website and I went, duh. And so I immediately got in touch with her and she was available. So I said, tonight's the night.
Yeah.
I knew you'd like that.
Yeah. It's so many of my recreational cycling friends go out of their way to avoid roads that are just the least bit trafficked by cars.
Right.
And I don't necessarily like to, you know, put myself in with cars if I don't have to, but I don't think you should have to shy away from it either.
No, I agree. I think most of it's out of fear.
Mm.
Wasn't it somebody, I can't remember who it was, that said that they think that the motorists are just as afraid as
the
cyclists?
A lot of them are. Yeah,
that was from an interview we did over a year ago. Yeah, just, I knew you'd like her.
Hey, in all my miles, my only serious crash was not involving a motor vehicle.
It was distracted cycling.
Although I was hit when I was a teenager.
Were you?
Yeah,
ooh.
Once. Yeah, this was before helmets. That explains a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know. I'm glad you said it.
All right, well, we've got to get along out of here.
Yes, we do.
And we're going to come back next week with another killer show.
We are indeed, and that will be the last show until I go to press camp.
Okay.
The following week, I get to go to Park City, Utah, and do the show from there. So you might learn some new stuff.
Okay, cool.
I might learn some new stuff.
All right. Well, until then, enjoy the beautiful weather and ride safely and ride lots.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.